KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
Hi, I'm Kim Masters. Thanks for listening to the Business Podcast. You know, KCRW produces another podcast that you might want to check out. My frequent banter buddy, Michael Schneider, hosts it. It's called The Spinoff. It's about television, industry insights and trends, and shows that we watch or shows that we don't. Find The Spinoff on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
Most of the men on my crew had not worked with a woman director. And if they'd worked with a woman director, she wasn't Black. I thought it was important just to make it very clear what I expected and what I intended to have happen.
Before she started filming Selma, director Ava DuVernay laid down the law. She tells us about her clear vision for the film and how she made it without cooperation from Martin Luther King's family, which precluded her from using any of his legendary speeches. But first on the News Banter, the semi-annual gathering of television critics is dominated so far by talk of cutting the cord. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my buddy in banter, Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Kim.
So I'm just going to give a nod to the Golden Globes. They are going to happen after we're taping. And as you know, it's like a little group of somewhat dubiously credentialed foreign journalists.
Some would say a nod is more than enough credence you need to give to the Golden Globes.
But, you know, the thing about the Globes is they've turned into this gigantic deal. I mean, I remember a few years ago, they were goofy, they were fun, nobody really cared. And now you have to go, you have to show up, you have to play nicely, because if you look ungracious, it could really bite you.
Yeah, and what's interesting now is everyone has seen what the Dick Clark Productions and the HFPA and NBC did in revitalizing the Globes. And now they're trying to do it with all these other award shows, Critics' Choice and on, where they're taking these small award shows and trying to make them big mega events as well.
Right. But the Globes, you got to hand them credit. They did very well with what they got. Now, the Oscar nominations are coming out in a few days. And I will just mention that the Academy looks a little bit anxious about the ratings because the movies that are appearing to be in contention, they're not a lot of big blockbuster movies this year.
And we know when it's more indie-focused movies, the ratings go down. You had the year where Titanic, of course, was the big winner, and that's still sort of the big hallmark of ratings for the Oscars. And then you have other years where smaller movies are in and the ratings just aren't there. And the competition is so hefty now on Sunday nights.
I guess there was a leak from the Academy about what their plan is to try to sell this thing with Neil Patrick Harris, who is great, but not necessarily a gigantic draw for the Oscars. I'll watch him.
Yeah, so they're going to set aside over $5 million in extra money to try to promote this thing on different platforms, both on traditional media sources, but also online.
And of course, they have ABC already promoting it, so they're going to try to give it a little extra push with Academy money.
Yeah, their biggest concern are zombies, Walking Dead up against it on AMC.
Stiff competition, although the Oscars are one of those event things. But let's talk about what is going on in Pasadena as we speak. The Television Critics Association has gathered. They are having these panels. They do this twice a year. And each network and programming entity, because now we have Netflix participating, comes in and basically answers questions from critics about programming that's about to be going on the air in the next few weeks.
Yeah, pimps their wares. And 2015 is an interesting year because we've got a lot of big shows going away. Mad Men, Parks and Recreation, Glee, some others as well. So you have new shows coming in, but you also have some really hot topics that are sort of captivating everyone. The biggest story of the year probably is going to be this over-the-top emergence that we're seeing already. HBO announced that they're introducing a new service called HBO Go later this year where you won't need a cable subscription anymore. You can buy HBO directly from the source. Dish just announced a new service called Sling TV where you can pop down money and just get 20 channels on your iPod. Or
and not just any channels.
And some big ones including ESPN, which is a big deal. That's a game changer to have a sports network on there. So certain, especially younger demos, millennials, who weren't going to buy a cable subscription anyway, can now just go and buy Sling TV, Netflix, and feel like they're done.
So everybody's kind of getting into the game because they're nervous if they sit there, something bad will happen. CBS jumped in like instantly after HBO announced its over-the-top service.
And others are to come. Sony is looking at an internet TV service. There's others as well. So the big question is also going to be, will this impact cord cutting and just the way people buy television? So that remains to be seen. Stay tuned, as they say.
Mike, you're in the room there at the TCA meeting, this television critics meeting. I mean, some of the current news has been very much on the minds of people who are asking these questions. I believe Tina Fey was asked, for example, about this terrible murder in Paris, the Charlie Hebdo killings.
Yes, and people are sort of merging that along with what happened with Sony at the end of the year as sort of an issue of free speech and expression. And obviously, folks like Tina Fey, Tina Fey, who became famous because of her outspoken political comedy on Saturday Night Live, did have a lot to say. And this is a chilling effect, and that creatives everywhere have to rise up and not let this deter them from continuing to express themselves freely.
Of course, it's kind of an apples and oranges, to put it mildly. The whole thing with the interview is not exactly comparable to the situation in Paris by any means.
Right, right. Although there was a threat of violence at some point in that case as well, which
there was
which
a
led
threat
to
of
a
violence,
chilling effect.
And there are issues of freedom of expression, broadly speaking. Sony, meanwhile, has gone back to work, you know, after the attack that we made so much news at the end of the year. A lot of people in town were thinking, you know, that the head of the studio, at least Amy Pascal, possibly also chairman of Sony, Michael Linton, were just going to have to be fired and would be fired anywhere else. But so far, you know, they're back to work. They are sending out the signals that it's business as usual. And not only that it's business as usual, but that they sort of triumphed because they did manage this release, this simultaneous release on a ton of different platforms.
Yeah, what's interesting is people were taken aback when President Obama went out there and criticized Sony for canceling the distribution of the interview. But honestly, that gave them cover to actually turn around and distribute it, both over video on demand and also with independent movie theaters. And that ended up being the best situation. And it sort of
In this circumstance.
And this is a very unique circumstance. But it quelled a lot of those critics. And I think people are starting to move on.
But it looks like for the moment, Sony corporate in Tokyo doesn't want to appear to have been bullied by North Korea, and it is unique in Hollywood. It's a Japanese company far, far away. And I truly do feel, and I'm certainly reflecting what I hear from my sources around the town, that nowhere else would you survive. But for the foreseeable future, that administration may, in fact, survive.
Yeah.
And there's damage with theater owners, relationships, talent relationships. But you know what? When you write a check in Hollywood, sometimes a lot of things get forgotten.
And it is a new year, so maybe a new perspective.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Kim.
That's Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. Selma is the first feature film about Martin Luther King Jr., focusing on a 3-month period in 1965 during which he played a key role in organizing a pivotal march in Alabama to push for a federal Voting Rights Act. British actor David Oyelowo plays the civil rights leader, adopting King's cadence, if not his exact words.
As long as I am unable to exercise my constitutional right to vote, I do not have command of my own life. I cannot determine my own destiny, for it is determined for me by people who would rather see me suffer than succeed. Those that have gone before us say, no more, no more. That means protest, that means march, that means disturb the peace, that means jail, that means risk, and that is hard.
Filmmaker Ava DuVernay could not get the rights to King's speeches, so she wrote those words herself. She's already made history as the first African-American woman to be nominated for Best Director at this year's Golden Globes. But like other films based on historical events, Selma has attracted controversy. In this case, controversy that arose after we taped our interview with DuVernay. The issue is the film's depiction of President Lyndon Baines Johnson, with the Johnson historian and some others contending that the film doesn't give the president enough credit for his support of the Voting Rights Act. Others, including Gay Talese, who covered the events depicted in the film for the New York Times, have defended the movie. DuVernay has not directly engaged in this debate, saying on Twitter, "Bottom line is folks should interrogate history. Don't take my word for it or LBJ's rep's word for it." If any filmmaker should be prepared to deal with controversy, it's DuVernay, who had a long career as a film publicist before she started writing and directing movies herself.
My specialty was hybrid films and niche campaigns. So I started my own agency when I was 27, and I worked with all of the major studios and networks on campaigns where, you know, they were enlightened enough to know that the core audience was not just white men, that they had to reach women or LGBT people or black or brown or just being very aware that there are riches in the niches. So I would come in and do that work and cross it over back into the mainstream. A lot of strategic publicity.
And then I read that one day you were watching, I think it was it Michael Mann directing
on the
Collateral?
I was on the set
movie?
Of Collateral, yeah.
And you thought, I could do this.
Yeah, I was on the set of Collateral, and we were shooting in East L.A., and I just, you know, had a story that I was aware of that happened just a few streets over because I'm from South Central L.A., Compton area. So I almost immediately started tinkering on a script and became one of those many, many people who have a script in the drawer.
So you started out making a doc.
Yeah.
And it was a $10,000 budget, I think. Is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. I just made it check to check. You know, as I would make money from my publicity clients, I would put it towards this doc that I was making about this group of artists in South Central LA who were doing innovative things with hip-hop and progressive movements in that area. It was a good way to begin picking up a camera and telling stories.
I mean, making this transition, many have tried and few have actually made this transition, but do you think that's a way to go? Is that a necessary first step? Like, start out with a doc. Tell a story with a doc.
I think the real thing is just to begin with small steps. I think most people think their dream has to happen all at once. I need to make a film, so I need to make a huge feature film, and it needs to be X, Y, and Z, or I want to make music, so it needs to be a whole album, and it needs to be like this. And, you know, what I really realize is your dream can happen a little bit at a time, and so each step takes a little bit longer, but you can really savor it and learn from it. And so for me, a doc was something that I can get my arms around, I could pay for on my own, and I can kind of learn the craft and get to the end goal in a more progressive way.
I saw that you had given a speech to it's something called Black Star, which I guess is a conference.
Oh, yes, that's a little known tape. Yes. What did I say? Oh, my goodness.
You said you were talking to a predominantly African-American audience, and you were saying, as it was reported, that you were talking to this audience about how to find private money to finance
yes.
films. You said, it's not about knocking on closed doors. It's about building our own house and having our own door.
That's right. That's right. Well, I'm just really allergic to, you know, dealing in a permission-based way. I think that, you know, that is what the industry is. It's all about knocking on doors, permission, begging, please, can you help me? Can you do this for me? My idea is really good. Please say yes. And, you know, that's always a challenge for women filmmakers, for filmmakers of color. And I think being a publicist for so many years gave me insight into some of the way that the industry works. And so I didn't go into it bright-eyed, bushy-tailed as a filmmaker thinking everyone's going to think my idea is great and give me money. I went in with my eyes wide open, knowing that I was going to have to, you know, find my own way, as most independent filmmakers do. And yeah, so it's just about building, you know, our own systems and ways to do things, which is why I created a firm.
Don't necessarily go to Paramount, which is doing this movie, or Disney or Fox, and expect them to give you permission.
Well, it's just not their model. You know, it can get personal. We can call it systemic. We can call it, you know, that there are racial overtones there, class overtones there, sexist overtones there. But the bottom line is, it is not their current business model. So do you not make your film? I mean, do you not do it? What do? You find another model. You find another way to do it. And so that was my goal. If you're waiting around for someone to change their mind in order for you to speak your mind, you're going to be waiting a long time.
So you moved on from there to doing dramatic film.
Yes.
I Will Follow.
Yes.
Did you say to yourself, now I am ready to do this?
Same idea. Took $50,000 that I'd been saving for a house, and instead of buying a house, I bought a career. And, you know, made a film, backed into the number, wrote a film that I knew I could make for $50,000. So all in one location, a very personal story, intimate story. And that film paid off for me. I was able to self-distribute that film, do the DVD deal, do the digital deals, do a small theatrical release through my distribution company that I had founded for my own films and other films like the ones I make, focused on Black life. And yeah, I was able to kind of triple or I think now quadruple that little bit of money and put it into the next one. So it was really just about, you know, taking a little bit of seed money and growing it from film to film and just trying to find a way where they didn't seem like there was any way.
Where did you get that entrepreneurial gene?
My dad. My dad has a small carpet and flooring company for all of my life. And I would see him go out very early in the morning when it was dark outside, get in a truck with his name on the side and make his own way. And, you know, never got a paycheck, you know. I haven't had a paycheck, an actual check,
paid to me with taxes taken out, you know what I mean? That I didn't have to worry about where it was coming from. And I don't know, I guess it's almost 20 years now. But once you're in that entrepreneurial spirit, it's hard to go the other way.
So after I Will Follow, you moved on and made a bigger film, Middle of Nowhere. So you're just combining this enterprise with incredible pragmatism, really.
I think so. I mean, I think I went into this with my eyes wide open about what it was, you know, didn't have any big dreams to be making films at any high level. I know a lot of filmmakers want to get to that $20 million, $30 million, $50 million level, $100 million films, a success to them, the budget's escalating, going up each time. For me, you know, as a Black woman filmmaker, I just wanted to make films consistently. My goal was just to make a film or make something every year. You know, Spike Lee was a great example of that. He made a film every year for 20 years. He made commercials. He made docs. He was always shooting. So I think that, you know, idea of it doesn't have to be bigger. It just needs to be consistent. Gave me a different idea about, you know, focusing on work as a constant instead of as a ladder. And yes, I mean, by fluke, it has been a bit of a ladder, but it wasn't by design.
So you didn't necessarily say to yourself, I have to have a $50 million budget, but you did make a big leap with Selma. That was that's a $20 million film, a much different proposition. It was a long gestation period for Selma. You weren't even involved, and it was being handed from, I read a list. It was Michael Mann, Stephen Frears, Paul Haggis, Spike Lee, Lee Daniels.
Yeah.
That movie wasn't going to get made.
No, I wasn't the first, second, third, fourth, or fifth choice for this film. But I was David Oyelowo's choice. And he was, you know, the one who was really destined to play this part. And so he's the unsung hero of this from a business side. He actually put the pieces together when the project was kind of dormant. You know, some beautiful producers were able to kind of keep it alive for a long time, but it was never coming together. David brought me into the project, brought Oprah Winfrey into the project. And, you know, within a couple of months after that, we were in pre-production.
You had worked with him on Middle of Nowhere.
Yeah, I'd worked with him on Middle of Nowhere.
And then he actually had been sort of cast as Martin Luther King and then uncast as...
Well, he had been cast by Lee Daniels, and when Lee Daniels left the project to make The Butler, he was an actor without a movie. And yeah. So, you know, being the very entrepreneurial man that he is and someone who had a lot of passion about this part and the story, he did something that not a lot of actors do. He decided that he was going to try to push to put the film together himself via the producers that were already attached and bringing in some fresh blood.
The producers being?
Pathé and Plan B. Yeah.
Right. That's Brad Pitt's company,
that's
obviously.
Right.
And Pathé had been involved, I think, even from the beginning.
Oh, yeah. Pathé was involved from the very, very beginning.
So what was it that was so hard? I mean, some things are more obvious than others. But, I mean, I know that you had no cooperation whatsoever from the King family, and you had to – we'll get to that. But what about the story makes it so difficult to tell?
Well, I think, I mean, we'd be sitting here being disingenuous if we didn't, you know, recognize that, you know, dramas with a Black protagonist by Black directors are not top of the list of studio chiefs to greenlight. They're not sitting around thinking, which Black filmmaker could we make a historical Black drama with a Black lead? It's not top of the list. And so I think, you know, over the years, that's been one of the issues. But then also, you know, I mean, how do you approach such a big life? And what is that really? And what does it look like? And I don't know if there were just not enough filmmakers who were passionate enough to push it through. I'm not sure. Certainly, you know, the speeches and the estate were a stumbling block for some people to get around. You know, a lot of factors. You look at the foreign, the same old myth.
Right.
The same
black
old,
movies,
you know,
don't play foreign.
Yeah, this antiquated.
So-called Black movies. I should
That's
say.
That's right. Very antiquated, you know, in my view, ignorant, in that it is not progressive in any way. It's not moving forward. It's just the same old lie being repeated again and again. And so all that is a stew that made for a film with Dr. King at the center never being released in theaters. We are 50 years from the time that these events happened. There have been biopics about Jimmy Hoffa. I hear they're making one on the lady who created Tupperware. I'm sure she's lovely, but I think Martin Luther King Jr. should have one as well.
Coming up after a short break, DuVernay on how she overcame the hurdle of making a film about Martin Luther King without having permission to use any of his speeches. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Ava DuVernay, the director of Selma, which follows Martin Luther King Jr.'s historic civil rights march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama. Making Selma was fraught with challenges, but DuVernay had a powerful ally in Oprah Winfrey, a Selma producer who also has a role in the film. DuVernay says for Winfrey, this was much more than a vanity project.
It was quite a process. And so she was so entrenched in that that she wasn't keen on taking a part as an actor. But, you know, the list of black women in their early 60s with that strong presence who do very well at period of films is a short list. And she's at the top of it.
So did people kind of say, I want to be in this movie?
Or yeah. Yeah, it started to be one of those things because it's a very large cast, a large ensemble. And once it started to get around town, the call started to come in from black, white, old, young. I mean, folks really interested in the project. And we did have a very specific and more humble budget for this that everybody was really aware that they weren't going to get rich off of it. So it was really just a passion play. And everyone that was there really wanted to be.
And I read, and I kind of love this, I have to admit, that you told your crew, this is going to run in the way that I want it to run at the beginning. That was what you told your crew. Is that based on something you had observed in your earlier experience? What made you, like, lay down the law like
that?
No,
I mean, it wasn't said. I mean, when you read it in print,
it sounds a little different.
But no, I mean, yeah. I really just sat down with everyone and just made it very clear that I was inviting them to work with me on a project that I felt passionately about and that, you know, it was going to be, you know, executed through my vision and the way that I work. Most of the men on my crew had not worked with a woman director. And if they'd worked with a woman director, she wasn't black. I felt it was important just to make it very clear what I expected and what I intended to have happen.
That would scare me, I have to tell you.
Would it?
Looking me in the eye and saying, I'd be like, I better do what she says.
No, I mean, it was a lovely collaboration. But, you know, I mean, if you've never worked with someone or a certain kind of person and you don't know what to expect, you know, I had a conversation very early on so everyone knew what
to expect.
Tell
them what you expect.
That is correct.
Now, you getting to this issue of the speeches. I mean, your Martin Luther King speaks in this emotional way, and it is known that you had to write all of it.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, the intellectual property wasn't available to us. So the question was, do we not tell the story? And so I just untethered myself from the words and really tried to get underneath what he was trying to say. King was a big ideas guy, real intellectual. The concepts are so advanced and really, really just amazing, amazing stuff when you read it. And so I thought if I could just get underneath the words to what he intended to say and communicate and share, I would be okay. And so finally, my mother was very happy because my English Lit African American Studies double major time at UCLA finally came
right.
in handy.
What are you going to do with that?
What are you going to do with that? Well, I'm going to rewrite some Dr. King. That's what I'm going to do, ma'am. And it all worked.
That's awesome. I mean, that is daunting. I am going
it
to
is.
Be Martin Luther King's speechwriter posthumously.
That's right. It's daunting. But, you know, it was fascinating to get inside his head and to really sink myself into those speeches and go beyond the words and really, sometimes the words obscured what he was trying to say because he was such a beautiful orator.
I mean, I think it would astonish people to think that something like a public speech that Martin Luther King made is not a public thing.
But he was not a public person. He was a private citizen. He was not the president of the United States. He's a leader that
doesn't
we
feel like a private citizen.
He's a private citizen, and his work was copywritten. And so, yeah, everything that we use of Lyndon Johnson is public record. And he was the president of the United States, but King was a preacher from Atlanta, and his works are private.
So when he meets with Lyndon Johnson, as he does more than once in your film, did you have to make up his words and use Johnson's?
I mean, it's a film, so it's everything is dramatized and fictionalized.
But didn't Johnson record some of that stuff?
Yeah. Some of his phone calls in the White House I recorded over the time of his presidency, which spans, you know, far beyond the 3 months that we focus on. So
right. They're
not a lot that were during our time, but it was great to listen to them talk to each other because I got a sense of the relationship and the way that they dealt with one another. And we did put a lot of that into the work that David Oyelowo does with Tom Wilkinson.
Yeah. It's very, watching him
Martin Luther King pressure Lyndon Johnson, who is a formidable figure in his own right, is quite a drama.
Yes.
And, you know, so many filmmakers seem to gild lilies. Mm. And maybe with Martin Luther King, you feel like, A, there's no need. As often, I think there's no need in these dramatized versions of reality. But, and also, it's almost sort of a sacred story.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, in previous scripts that I'd read and other filmmakers are trying to approach, in the way that they're trying to approach the story, he's either a saint or it's a takedown. It's an overcompensation on both sides. He was a man. He was a human being. He was he had foibles. He was a man of faith who was sometimes unfaithful. He was guilty. People died on his watch during this time, this 3-month period. He had an ego. He was a human being like all of us.
Well, and you show a very political mind.
Well, and
calculating
he was
how to make this work.
Exactly right. He was a strategist. He was a tactician. He was an intellectual. I think that there's been this dumbing down of King, this homogenization of the civil rights movement, where everyone was a saint and they came in peace and then they died. And, you know, that's a disservice to what that really happened there. They were radicals. And there were very, very intricate concepts behind the idea of nonviolence. It was brave. It was bold. And it wasn't just kind of lay down and get hit. It was, there was much more behind it. And so
if the film
does anything, I hope it shows that. Yes.
It certainly does.
Good.
Yes. I just will return for a second on this issue of the family. I mean, was it foreclosed to you? Was there an appeal made to the family?
No, we didn't reach out. They're not available. All of the rights to his speeches and his intellectual property are with another filmmaker. As a courtesy, we reached out to the family. We let them read the script in advance just so they knew what we were making. But there were no changes made and no changes asked for by them. You know, Ms. Winfrey knows the family, so I think that they were clear that her intentions were to, you know, tell the truth of the time period.
I'm sort of struck that Paramount, of all studios, ended up being, you know, a part of your film. There was a dispute over the previous Plan B film with an African-American, you know, 12 Years a Slave, mm-hmm. with theme, star, et cetera. They claimed they were never offered the film. They were very angry about that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure whether the people at Plan B, Brad Pitt and Dee Dee Garner and Jeremy Kleiner, feel that they didn't, but whatever, we'll leave that to them. But
yeah, I wasn't there. Don't know.
Is this like the film that they were like, okay, we screwed up on the last one, we better get this one because these guys might be onto something?
I don't know. I would hope not. I think that the support that I felt from those folks, Brad Gray and Adam Goodman and Mark Evans and everyone over there, has been just very robust. You know, I mean, they've been working on some lovely films like Ninja Turtles and Transformers for quite a while.
Exactly.
And so what I felt is a real excitement about adult drama there.
Yes, general practice.
Sure.
It's not like you think of, yeah, Paramount,
right.
Home
of the fine, yes, the fine black historical dramas, which is, this is not what this is. This is an American story. But I feel like, you know, what I felt, my experience working with Paramount was from all departments, post, because this was a negative pickup. So, you know,
they didn't actually finance the film.
Yeah, we started working with them towards the end of production. Me, an independent filmmaker, was really wary about the quote-unquote studio and how that was going to work. I thought people were going to be giving me bad notes, and I don't take bad notes really well. But they weren't bad notes. They were great notes, and they were smart people, and it was a really lovely process. And, you know, I can barely believe I'm saying it, but me, Miss Queen of Indie, had a really cool experience with the studio.
This was your first time.
first run-in with the suits.
Yeah.
And they were good eggs.
So the black question and the woman question, I always have a slight pang when I ask a woman, because I feel like, you know, a lot of women just are like, can I just make a film? Can I just be black? Can I just? But I don't think you can. I don't even think you necessarily feel that you should.
And I respect people who feel that way. Certainly, I completely respect that point of view. It's just not my point of view. There's some black filmmakers that don't want to be called black filmmaker. They just want to be a filmmaker. Some women that just want to be called a filmmaker, not a woman filmmaker. I'm a black woman filmmaker. That's my identity. That's the gaze through which I make my work. It doesn't mean that only black women can watch my work. I think it's ridiculous to think that folks are grown. Look, we're all adults. We all should be at a point right now that you can listen to stories from all kinds of minds and all kinds of folk. And so I believe in the good of people. I don't think that I'm limiting myself by calling myself what I am.
Ava DuVernay is the director of Selma. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I like this show.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna.
You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.